Okay, we're back at it.
Many guys who aren't from Oklahoma, Barry, you have no idea. We don't like them. It's personal.
How about them Cowboys? Yeah.
It's only one Oklahoma, and it was state. And it was state.
We are back at it. Welcome back to another edition of the Pistols Firing Podcast. I'm Carson Cunningham, joined as always by Colby Powell. Colby, how are you on this beautiful Thursday?
I am doing great. The Arnold Palmer Invitational is on. It is a beautiful day. It's a beautiful spring so far in the state of Oklahoma, and it's not even spring yet.
It's been also mild. Been loving it.
Yeah, it has been. It's been great. Also, ski season is officially over. Went to Breckenridge for a long weekend and had some fun in the sunshine and then in the powder. So ski season is officially over, and it's time to play some golf.
Yeah, you sent me a picture of one of your runs. And I gotta say, that's pretty impressive, Colby. That's a steep mountain you're skiing down. I texted you back, said I'd rather be on a golf course, but hey, teach their own. But nonetheless, I gotta consider you an athlete. I know you're mostly a golfer, but that's pretty athletic to go down a mountain that steep.
I appreciate it. I've skied some steep stuff in my day. If I were to handicap my skiing, like how we have golf handicaps, I'm probably pretty close to scratch on some skis. Wow. So I enjoy it. And I look forward to getting back into it next year. I'm just every year when I get to the end of ski season and I haven't hurt myself, so I don't have to take time away from golf, that is how I rate whether it's a success or failure. And it was a massive success this year. No injuries to speak of.
That's great, because you're one slope away from an injury, a massive one. So I'm glad you're not, in a full body cast doing this podcast. That'd be rather difficult. We're hitting kind of the spring season. You said it's not spring yet, but we're getting close. Basketball's winding down. But first, let's hear from Chris's University Spirit, your one-stop cowboy shop. Be sure to shop at chrisuniversityspirit.com. Colby, I recently purchased a OSU baseball hat. I went with the all-black with the interlocking OS on it. So I'm ready for baseball season. But if you need a hat, need a bill, go to Chris's University Spirit. They'll hook you up, and they have all the best and latest, greatest headwear apparel. Do you have a baseball hat?
I don't believe I do have an Oklahoma State baseball hat. I need one. I definitely want to get to a game this year and take the kiddo. She turns 2 here in a few weeks. So definitely want to get her up there. And nice sweep over the weekend for Oklahoma State baseball. So maybe things are starting to go in the right direction as we get into the season a little bit more.
Yep. We'll be getting in more into baseball as we progress through the spring season. I mentioned basketball's winding down. Not a whole lot to talk about here, Colby. OSU loses to Texas Tech 75-58. Really just more of the same, poor shooting, poor defense, and really just an all-around bad year for Oklahoma State, especially from home. Just a very poor home record. As we all know, in Big 12 conference play, you got to protect your home court if you want to have any chance of making the NCAA tournament. It was senior night, but more of the same. Not a whole lot to touch on. Really, the only questions remaining, Colby, is what's going to happen with the program once the season's over with Mike Boynton, really?
Yeah, that's the big question to me is Mike Boynton and the roster after the season. Yeah. Like that game the other night, I don't know if you watched it. I planned on turning it on when we got home. I wasn't home when it started. By the time we got home, it wasn't that far into the game, and they were down by 15, maybe 17. So at that point, I didn't even turn it on. I went on about my night. I've got other things to do. It's not a watchable product at that point. Did you actually sit down and invest time in that game the other night, or are you kind of where I'm at?
No, I'm pretty much out. I don't even, it wasn't this game. It was the UCF game. I kind of forgot they were playing, and I saw a few tweets and tuned in for a little bit, but this game, once I saw they didn't score in the first 5 minutes, why am I investing any time watching that?
Yeah, good for you on not watching the UCF game. I watched a lot of basketball this year, and for me, the season pretty much mentally was over after the UCF game. A poor performance from Oklahoma State, but also just the pinnacle of college officiating and thinking we're there to see them. Just borderline record-breaking amounts of foul calls and free throw shot. It was unwatchable. This game the other night, I don't think I take a lot from that game particularly. It's a lot of what we've seen. What matters to this basketball program is what happens in the few weeks after the season is over, whether Mike Boynton sticks around, which I think he will, because of a myriad of predicaments that he's found himself in with the NCAA things. Then he has the one good year, gets the contract extension. So now he's got the buyout that seems untenable at this point, the lack of NIL investment that we've discussed. And I don't know if that's going to get better or not, because where is the enthusiasm to donate to a program that's losing right now at a perpetual rate? It's kind of the chicken and the egg. Are they losing because you're not donating, or are you not donating because they're losing? So I just think the basketball program is in a really, really tough spot right now. And I think what happens with the portal this offseason will be indicative of where this team is headed, because Avery Anderson leaves, gets a bunch of money. Moses Cisse leaves, gets a bunch of money. And I just don't know if it's going to be the same with Jamyron Keller and Brandon Garrison and Eric Daly and these guys. If they head out somewhere else to go get a bunch of money, then it's just going to be a reset and probably more bad basketball next season. So what happens after the season is over is far more interesting to me at this point than what is happening in these remaining few games.
Yeah, totally. I think it's time to figure out what Chad Weiberg envisions happening with this program. I think Mike Boynton's argued that, you know, he needs more NIL funding. I think every program at OSU would probably argue that at this point with the way college sports are. But some big questions for Chad Weiberg. And we have some kind of higher level questions involving that from our Twitter followers. I put out a call for some Twitter questions. We'll get into that as well. But the Big 12 basketball tournament will be held in Kansas City once again. Starts on March 16th. And, you know, the Big 12, just they try stuff. I'll give them that. They do try stuff. They got a lot of stuff going on with some private tables. They've got Charlie Hustles up there with some custom merchandise. And they have food. They have Big 12 team-related food. Oklahoma State is the OSU's Orange Power Pizza, which I think it's pepperoni, sausage, ham, sweet pepper, bacon. They basically just ripped off the Big Country, it looks like to me, from Hideaway. They just can't call it the Big Country because that's Hideaway's pizza. But I thought that was interesting. They got the Orange Power Pizza. But I doubt too many OSU folks will be making the trip up to Kansas City.
No, I can't imagine that's how Oklahoma State fans are going to be spending their money at this point. That's a quality pizza, by the way. The Big Country. I mean, there's a lot
my favorite.
At Hideaway. I'd say the Big Country and the Pepperoni Palooza are my go-tos.
Yeah, I'm more of a Big Country guy. I think that's their tried and true staple. That's definitely what I go for. But you got to like the meats. It's definitely a meat lover style. I wanted to transition. This really just stuck in my craw. Is it stuck in my craw or crawl?
I believe it is craw. I don't know what the origin of that is. I'm going to look it up while you're talking.
Yeah, this really stuck in my craw. That is the correct means to rankle or irritate one. That this article rankled me and irritated me. It's a guy I really like, and Bruce Feldman, who I think has always done a really good job covering college football. Just he ranks his top 25 coaches, and before I even clicked on it, I was like, you know what? At this point with these articles, I expect Mike Gundy to be ranked too low, despite all the facts, despite all of his ranked wins, despite the fact he's top 10 in wins since 2010. In fact, he's the third longest tenured coach in all of college football. I was like, you know what? They'll probably put him in the teens. He has the audacity to put Mike Gundy at 20, 20th in the country. And that may not sound like huge disrespect before you look at the list, but I kind of wanted to go through some of these, Colby. But first, just your reaction on Mike Gundy being 20.
Yeah, I think if we want to keep some of these clickbaity things from happening in the future, then we need to allow something like this to discredit pretty much all of Bruce Feldman's college football opinions. Because if you can rank Mike Gundy at 20th on your list, then how can I trust anything that you're saying about college football if you clearly just don't have a base understanding? I mean, I'm going through this list, and it is absolutely melting my brain, some of the names that are above Mike Gundy. And I really don't know if this is just for engagement in an area where everyone's craving clicks and craving engagements. And so you put that down there to get a fan base riled up, but that's not what it does to me. It gets me less riled, and it just more so makes me look at Bruce Feldman and think, okay, that is a name that I can cross off in terms of knowledgeable college football opinions. And I understand that these lists are hard and you're going to make somebody mad along the way, but there's just no validity to a list that has Mike Gundy as the 20th best coach in the country. It doesn't make any sense.
No, it makes zero sense at all. And I just want to kind of want to go through it. I mean, Luke Fickell at Wisconsin. I mean, he did a good job at Cincinnati. He won a lot of games there. But now that he's in the big leagues, hadn't done too hot so far at Wisconsin. I know it's only been 1 year, but to me, he's way unproven in comparison to Mike Gundy. Certainly, but his tenure and this one really bothered. I listed a few that bothered me. This Matt Rhule is 18, and by Bruce's own write-up, Rhule's overall record is 52-50, two games over 500, and he basically just blames Nebraska stinking a lot for what Rhule's done in Nebraska. You know, Rhule did a good job at Baylor. We all know that, but how in what world do you rank Matt Rhule ahead of Mike Gundy?
Yeah, it doesn't make sense, and. The overall resume for Mike Gundy, like, I just don't get it. These flash-in-the-pan coaches that are on this list that have had a couple of successful seasons. It just seems to me like Bruce Feldman is rating a couple of successful seasons more highly than 20 years of consistent winning football at a program that, prior to Mike Gundy taking over at the helm, really not a lot was going on for Oklahoma State football. It's just... Again, I'm sure that some people outside of the Oklahoma State universe would look at us and accuse us of just having tunnel vision around the program that we cover. But I think the resumes, whenever you put them side by side, I mean, we've got Dave Clawson up here. What are we doing with Dave Clawson and with Jeff Brohm? I mean, what are we doing with Jeff Brohm? Mark Stoops at Kentucky? Ahead of Mike Gundy? Josh Heupel? Josh Heupel at 17, ahead of Mike Gundy. I just... Some of these things don't make sense, and I don't know if it was just for engagement, but that is the only thing that I can even wrap my mind around that makes it make sense, and I just don't respect things that are put out by supposed journalists, supposed experts that are just for engagement, and that's what it feels like this is. And I guess good on him because he got our engagement, but I don't know. It's going to make me look at everything Bruce Feldman puts out here on Forward and take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah, and I know he's in tight with a lot of these coaches. Maybe that has something to do with it. But you mentioned Heupel, went 8-4 last year, back to earth after one season of success at Tennessee. Chris Klieman at 12 bothered me as well. I mean, Mike Gundy has owned Chris Klieman. What is he, a 4-1 against him? The one blowout was only one win Chris Klieman has. And he tends to give a lot of respect to success at a lower level. You know, Chris Klieman coached at the FCS level with North Dakota State, which leads to, you know, the top 10 is mostly people you've heard of. Again, James Franklin needs to pay his agent more money because he's at 7, despite having done little to next to nothing at Penn State over the course of his tenure. I know he had a split division win in the Big Ten at one point, I think. Probably his only feather in his cap. But how about Lance Leipold, number three overall at Kansas? And he gives him so much credit for taking over. We all know what Kansas was when he moved there. It was the worst Power 5 job in the country. He gives him credit for his D3 titles and the job he did at Buffalo. But are we going to sit here and pretend like Oklahoma State was some sort of juggernaut when Mike Gundy got there? I mean, Les Miles had some decent success, but before that, OSU had done very little before Les Miles. It's kind of what have you done for me lately, I guess, with Lance Leipold coming off, you know, what he did at Kansas last year. But wake me up when Kansas wins 10 games, like, which Mike Gundy just seemingly does every other year.
Yeah, winning 10 games for Mike Gundy has become somewhat of a regularity at this point. And I don't even like that now I have to sit here and criticize Lance Leipold because he's too high on this list, because I think Lance Leipold is a great coach. Leipold, Leopold, however you pronounce it. I don't know if maybe these Division III national titles that he won are being weighted heavily. He won 6 Division III national titles. He was great at Buffalo. He's been great at Kansas. I like Lance Leipold. I don't really have a lot of negative things to say about the guy, but I don't know. I mean, his resume at the Division I level, you put it next to Mike Gundy's, they're not close. So maybe those Division III national titles are being weighted extremely heavily. Who knows what kind of success Mike Gundy could have had at that level. But I know what kind of success Mike Gundy's had at the D1 level for going on 20 years now. So at a non-blue blood, at a little brother in-state school, as everybody likes to say, and a program that doesn't get a lot of recognition nationally, and because Leopold pulls Kansas out of the gutter. He's the third best coach in the country. That's a big time reach. So I don't know. Maybe it's the Division III stuff, but the D1 resume just doesn't stack up. Again, it's extremely puzzling.
I would put Gundy. He has Kyle Whittingham at 8. I would put Gundy close to that. Maybe a little higher. Maybe a little lower. Probably right around 8 is good to me. And the reason why he lists Kyle Whittingham at Utah, he says he's gone 39-16 over the past full 4 seasons. Mike Gundy's won 37, so he's 2 wins shy of Kyle Whittingham, who he has 8th. It just, I don't know if he just dislikes Mike, doesn't have a relationship with him, just largely ignores Oklahoma State sports. I don't know, but just resume wise, even the last four full seasons, which he references, Gundy's got to be top 10. And Lincoln Riley is at 9 for reference sake, and James Franklin 7. I'd probably maybe put Gundy, replace James Franklin's ranking with Mike Gundy's, just flip flop those, put Franklin at 20. I'm good with that.
Franklin at 20 and Gundy at 7? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that would make more sense. I think Gundy's certainly proven a lot more than Lincoln Riley. Lincoln was really good in his time at Oklahoma. He's been, I think, pretty poor in USC, and he's underachieved out there. One of the qualifiers that he used to have Kyle Whittingham so long on his list, the Utes have beaten USC 3 times in the past 2 years. Well, yeah, Utah's a better team. USC wasn't that good. A lot of people were beating USC this last year, despite the fact that they had Caleb Williams. So, I think James Franklin at 20 and Mike Gundy at 7 makes this list so much more valid. James Franklin at 7 is wild, absolutely wild, to just be the 12th best team in the country because you beat up on Rutgers in Illinois every year. You never win a game that matters. Your fan base is tired of you. They know you can't win any games that matter. You get to beat Rutgers in Illinois every year. So good for you, I guess.
Yeah, and I have to mention Kirk Ferentz at 15. Friend of the show, Caden McFarland from Channel 2 up in Tulsa. I was, when I tweeted this out, I mentioned Rule, Kleiman, and Leipold. And Caden responding, you know, Ferentz is the one that drives me crazy. Both have uncommon longevity, but Gundy has won at a higher percentage at a program with less success historically, and he has twice as many wins over top 25 teams since 05. Gundy has 36 wins over top 25 teams. Ferentz has 18. Caden says, this one isn't hard, which, again, just maybe you're right, Colby. I mean, maybe Bruce just doesn't do that good of a job reporting because these numbers just, they speak for themselves. It's a completely objective. I know this list overall is supposed to be somewhat subjective based on who's a better coach, but when you're putting together lists like this, again, and the reason this sticks in my craw so much is people just don't view Mike Gundy in the right light. I continue to say he's going to be in the College Football Hall of Fame, and it seems like the national perspective on him doesn't view him that way. And why do you think that is, Colby? Is it simply because he only has one conference championship? Is it simply because the last time they saw him in a conference championship, they lost to Baylor? Is it simply because he couldn't win Bedlam consistently, especially when he had better teams? What do you think the reason for this lack of respect for Mike is? Because just any metric you want to list, he's a top 5 to top 10 coach in the country.
I'll give you an easy one, and the one that really stands out to me, and it is to me the primary reason that Mike Gundy doesn't get the respect that he deserves. He coached a national championship team in 2011 that didn't get the opportunity to play for the national championship. That was the best team in the country. If the BCS does not fail college football and we don't get a rematch of 9-6 in the title game between two SEC teams who had abysmal offenses back before the SEC actually learned how to move the football, Oklahoma State floppers LSU in that title game. Markel Martin and those guys on the back end would have just had a field day with whoever the quarterback was. I can't even remember at this point. Weed and Blackman would have went nuts. They would have won the national title, and Mike Gundy would be regarded as one of the best coaches in the country. So that is the one that stands out to me. The BCS failed college football in 2011, and Mike Gundy's reputation is still suffering as a result.
That's a great point, because how many national title games did Chip Kelly play in? One? Was it just the one he lost to Auburn and Cam Newton?
Yeah, when the kid got tackled, but he was on top of the defender and he bounced off the defender and ran for 50 yards. What a fluky way to decide a national title game.
Yeah, and Chip Kelly, I'm sure he was ahead of Mike on all these lists for the last 2, 3, 4 years, despite doing literally nothing since leaving Oregon, despite driving UCLA into the ground. And that's a great point, Colby, because look what look what that one title game appearance did for Chip Kelly and really Oregon as a program. I mean, Oregon, I would consider on a similar success to Oklahoma State, even though Oklahoma State's probably been more consistent over the last 10 years than Oregon, but everyone just ranks Oregon ahead of them in terms of, you know, prestige and program and all those things. So maybe I never really thought about just that one year, just being in the title game, let alone winning it. You're right. I think that would have earned Mike much needed respect for the end of time, really. So yeah, that's a good point. I think most of it has to do, Colby, with the lack of Big 12 title wins. I think people just look at conference championships in terms of your overall success. I think that's why Whittingham is so far ahead of Mike, even though, I mean, how many Pac-12 championships has Utah won? I'm going to look that up, but you look
how many has Iowa won? How many has Penn State won?
Not in our lifetime. But I think that maybe that's perhaps why, I mean, again, everyone, when they typically see Oklahoma State, it's in Bedlam, nationally televised, and they just could not get over the hump for so many years. Perhaps that to me, that combined with the lack of Big 12 championships, for me is probably the biggest reason why he didn't get the respect he deserves.
Yeah, I mean, I also think that conference championships are important, but I think if we're going to compare apples to apples, James Franklin and Kirk Ferentz ahead of Mike Gundy don't make sense. So, yeah, it just none of it makes sense. By the way, stuck in my craw means that someone has done or said something which created a large resentment in you, and its origin comes from hunters who noticed that some birds swallowed bits of stone that were too large to pass through the craw and into the digestive tract. These stones, unlike the sand and pebbles needed by birds to help grind food in the pouch, literally stuck in the craw and couldn't go down any further. Everyone learned something today on pistols firing.
That's great stuff. I will never say crawl ever again now that we've had this conversation. By the way, Oregon has won a ton of Pac-12 championships in recent years. Since 2009, they've won 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So maybe that's why they get more respect than Oklahoma State. Maybe they've earned it. But Utah's won 2 Pac-12 titles, 21 and 22, back-to-back years. So, again, if Mike Gundy scores a touchdown on the 1-yard line, his resume is even more identical to Kyle Whittingham. And Kyle Whittingham lost the Rose Bowl both of those years. Mike Gundy capitalized on the Fiesta Bowl the 2 times he's been. So I think you could almost give Mike an edge somewhat. But anyway, I just – that stuck in my craw, and I wanted to get that off my chest. What about Austin Ekrot, Colby? Were you able to tune in on Monday? They had a Monday finish due to weather, which stunk for him. He didn't get as many eyeballs on him winning his first PGA Tour event. Ooh. But just what a moment that was for Ekrot, who was, of course, famously on the same college team as Matthew Wolf and Victor Hovland.
Yeah, it was awesome for Austin Ekrot. Sunday was our final day skiing, and with the weather delay, we were able to get back and watch the golf, which was great until darkness set in. And then I listened to, I'm sure, my mom and my wife in the car with our toddler were quite annoyed at the 3 hours that we spent listening to PGA Tour radio as soon as we got up to drive early Monday morning. But yeah, listen to every shot, listen to his post-round interview. He said he changed his driver Tuesday of last week going into the tournament. And man, he just was lights out with his ball striking, just fairways and greens, fairways and greens, fairways and greens. And he made some putts. And I think that people underestimate how difficult it is to win in elite golf. It is so hard. Carson, it had been 5 years since Austin Ekrot won anywhere on any tour at any level worldwide. It had been 5 years. And that guy is so, so, so good. It is just so hard to win. I think sometimes it gets taken for granted whenever you look at a guy and you say, oh, it's a great player. He's going to win. Of course he's going to win. It's not that easy to just go win at these elite levels of golf because there are 150 other guys in that field who are also unreal and also have people in their hometowns saying, man, that guy's so good. He's got to win. I was so happy for Austin. I was able to interview him in person at Prairie Dunes back when he was with Oklahoma State, and we went up there with the 73rd hole to cover that event. He's been great to that podcast when I was there and since I've left. That was, I think, the first show that he did after his win this week was with the 73rd hole. I listened to that interview this morning. I encourage everyone to go check that out. It was a great interview with Austin and just talking about how grateful he is, how excited he is to go play in the Masters. And I'm just so happy for him because job security on the PGA Tour is not a given, but when you win, boy, that just opens up a lot of things. So he's in all the signature events now. He's in the majors, and he's going to stick, and he's a really good player. So been 5 years since he had won anywhere. Had to sleep on the lead Saturday night, had to sleep on the lead Sunday night, and really just put his foot down and left the field in the dust. So incredible stuff from Austin Eckroat.
Yeah, I thought it was one of the more clutch final rounds I've watched in a while. I mean, you just watch these events, Colby, when guys have leads during final rounds, a lot of them get a little squirrely. I mean, just look back at like Luke List. Was that a Riviera where he had a lead and he started making bogeys after bogeys on the back nine because the moment got too big for him? And I thought that was the most impressive thing. I mean, he went through the bear trap, which just, you know, there's water everywhere, really tough shots coming in. It's no breeze coming into 18. And he just kept firing at pins. And the one squirrely shot he hit, he had to take a drop off of a storm drain, and it kind of hooked on him, went in the bunker. And Kurt Byram, who was calling the event, he was like aghast at his lie. It was a little downhill. There was water behind the green. So if he hits it too firm or scolds it, it's going in the water. He was like really nervous for Austin on this shot and looking at the difficulty of it. And when he clips this bunker shot so clean that Kurt Byram audibly gasped. He goes, ah, like he couldn't believe how good Eckroat hit that shot. He hits it to like 3 or 4 feet. And of course he missed the 3 or 4 footer, which is his only bogey coming in. But just after that, he was just pure nails. I mean, hit every green, fired at every pin. And it was one of the more clutch performances I'd seen in a while. He said afterwards he was really nervous, Colby, but you couldn't tell at all watching him.
No, you couldn't. And that hole that you referenced was number 14, which is right before you get to the bear trap. And on the radio, on PGA Tour radio, the on-course announcer said that he thought that Austin got a bad number from his caddy, that his caddy gave him the pin number to the front of the green as the front of the green number. And so he nuked it over into that back left bunker. So I would have been curious. I wish I could ask Austin that now and see if he did get a bad number there, but that was his only bogey, I believe, of the final round. And the 16th hole in the bear trap is a par four sandwiched between two par threes, and there's water all over the place on all three of those holes. And he said that he was really nervous for that tee shot on 16, because all week he had been able to hit iron off that tee, and the wind switched with that weather that came in. And in the final round, he had to hit a 3-wood off that tee. And for anybody who has played golf and knows, when you're comfortable with one club on a hole and then you have to switch and hit a club you're uncomfortable with, that can be a little dicey. And he striped it right down the middle. He hit the next one to 15, 20 feet. He rolled it in for a birdie that pretty much sealed the tournament. The 17th hole, there's water right. The pin was right. He hit it pretty much right over the flag. Probably pushed it a little bit, but that's why you aim left, right? He knows what his dispersion is. He knows where he needed to aim so that if he hit a maximum push, he still wouldn't be in the water. He'd be over by the pin. And that's what happened. So that's not luck. That's smart golf. And it was a great performance. I really hope. I think that he's a great ambassador and a great representative of the state of Oklahoma. He won the state championship at Edmund North, a program that won like 9 straight state titles. He makes the team as a freshman and then wins 6A state as a freshman. I believe he was the first player to do that. He made the squad in 2018 for Oklahoma State on a team that included Matthew Wolf, Victor Hovland, Zach Boshu, Chris Ventura, Sam Stevens, Brennan Jelly. All of those guys still to this day playing professional golf, most either PGA Tour or Korn Ferry, and then Matthew Wolf over on LIV. He's been absolute nails throughout his career. He's had success at every level. And even with all that success, it's still hard to win. And I was so happy to see him lift a trophy and get all the exemptions that come with it. I can't wait to watch him play at the Masters. He's not a bomber, so I don't know if that course fits his style. I think if he were to ever win a major, I think his best chance would probably be across the pond in the Open Championship, used to playing in the wind growing up in Oklahoma, and distance typically is not as much of a factor in that major as it is.
Top 10 at the U.S. Open last year, didn't he?
Did he? Okay, I guess I didn't realize that. I didn't have his resume pulled up, but the other three majors just tend to emphasize distance a little bit more because those are longer courses. But if you hit the ball straight and you hit a bunch of greens, then I guess it doesn't matter what the distance of the course is. So hopefully he'll win a major one day. I think his best chance is at the Open. But yeah, just couldn't be happier for him. I love seeing the Oklahoma State guys have success on the tour.
I ran into him at a gas station about a year ago. I wasn't going to say anything to him because I don't want to be some sort of fanboy, but I recognized him, and he actually stopped me. He recognized me. I didn't think, you know, I've been out of TV a few years now, but he remembered me, and we just chit-chatted real quick, asked him, you know, he's living in the area. And this is right when his PGA career was getting started, I believe. And he's just a great dude. And I'll never forget, I was shooting on behalf of Channel 5 when I was working there. I was shooting the national championship up at Carson Creek, and it was the first round of match play. I think Oklahoma State was playing Texas. And it's pretty crazy that looking back on it now, but that match was, it was coming down to Austin. In terms of OSU could lose in the first round of match play on their home course. And I'm shooting 18, and he's in the fairway. And if you've ever played 18 at Carson Creek, especially if you play it from the tips, it's just a bear of a hole. And he hits this most, you know, I don't watch a ton of PGA Tour in person. I don't go to tournaments that often. So the list of great shots I've seen is pretty short anyway. But he hits one of the most beautiful golf shots I've ever seen. It was like a 3-wood, a mile high in the air, lands soft to about 5 feet. And he drills the putt. Just one of the most, and I captured it perfectly and put it out on Twitter. And I'll never forget that shot. And I think I remember tweeting, like, if Oklahoma State goes on to win a national championship, like, remember this shot to clinch his match. And because I think it was him and like Victor were still out on the course. So it was dicey there. And I'm so glad you brought up his high school career. Evan North is a juggernaut for people who know. I mean, he's not talked about in the same light as Hovland and Wolf because he didn't have the same individual college success. But every step of the way, he's an elite player. You mentioned the state championship as a true freshman. He played on a Walker Cup. To even crack the lineup like he did on the OSU team was ridiculous. He has been every bit of an elite golfer for his whole career. And I think a lot of the smart folks I've listened to after his win, they didn't just scoff at a relatively unknown name. They're like, this kid's been legit for a really long time. The people that know what they're talking about. And it's, you know, and one of my favorite ones is Andy Johnson, who does the Shotgun Start podcast and the Fried Egg podcast. And he made a good point. He said, stars aren't born overnight. He's like, but this Ekrot kid, like, this could be a jumping off point for him to where he's starting to regularly show up on leaderboards. You get this kind of win, you get your status. This could be a point where he really jumps off, Colby, and I'm excited to watch him grow because, unfortunately, Matt Wolf's kind of out of sight, out of mind on LIV, and we get to watch Victor every week, but it'll be nice to see what Ekrot's career ultimately turns out to become because he's got just an immense amount of talent.
Yeah, and I think a little bit of the lack of fanfare that has surrounded Ekrot as he's gone through college and into the pro game is, you know, people's heads turn when you win, right? When you hoist the trophy. And a lot of top fives, a lot of top tens in Ekrot's career. In college and on the PGA Tour, the Korn Ferry Tour, he finished second the year that he qualified for his tour card. He finished second on the Korn Ferry points list. And he finished second on the list without a win. I mean, the guys who finished in the top five, top 10 of that list on the Korn Ferry Tour are guys that have won once or twice throughout the season. He finished second with no wins. That just shows you the consistency week in and week out, but it's not as much of a head turner. And I agree. I've appreciated the conversation surrounding his victory this week because, you know, when one of your guys wins, and I know you're probably the same way I am. You want to go seek out the conversation about it. I've listened to several golf podcasts this week, including that interview this morning with the 73rd hole. And the conversation surrounding his victory among people who truly know what's happening in the golf world and what goes into winning these tournaments and being steady year in, year out, keeping your card, those things, have all said mostly the same things about Austin Ekrot, which is that despite not doing a ton of winning recently, this guy has been an exceptional player throughout his entire life and career. And now hopefully that he's gotten that first win in the bag, he can get a few more. But, I mean, even if he doesn't win again for a while, just to be in all these signature events, just keep being steady, keep having high finishes, put an amazing career together. He's only 25 years old. I mean, he could play another 25 years on the PGA Tour. He's that good. His swing is that repeatable. His spine angle is just like he's just twisting around a rod that's in his back. The club face is square at impact. This is kind of some nerdy stuff, but these are things that are sustainable. So, hopefully he can do more winning.
That putting stroke like dream worthy stuff. Like that's like what it's supposed to look like.
Yeah. A little bit more of a pop stroke as opposed to something. Yeah, like
I guess I'm referring more to the setup than the pop stroke, but
yes,
setup's
yes, no.
Magnificent.
setup's magnificent and it's repeatable. He does the same exact thing every time. So yeah, we're just lauding unbelievable praise on Austin Eckrow right now, but he's deserving of it because first win in 5 years, and hopefully it opens the floodgates.
Well, and one last note for me, and we can go to our toast of the week and then some Twitter questions. I just think it's really cool. He's a dude from Edmond. Like, Oklahoma State golf, as we know, recruits the world. I mean, they've had so many dudes from Sweden. We obviously know Hovland and Ventura from Norway. They all over the world. And the fact that it's a kid from Edmond who grew up at Oaktree, who grew up wearing OSU gear his whole life, who went on to star at Oklahoma State, who is now on the PGA Tour. It's just, I don't know. It makes me even almost more happy for an OSU guy, being a kid from my hometown, that's a local kid. It's just, it's pretty special. That's kind of one of my last takeaways from it.
Yeah, it's really special. You look at some of the biggest names in Oklahoma State golf: Victor Hovland's from Norway, Matthew Wolf's from California, Ricky was from California, Eugenio Chikara, he was from Mexico. Like, there haven't been a ton of local guys. There have been some. Taylor Gooch was one, had a successful career at Oklahoma State and is on Live, playing great on that tour. Austin Eckrow, though, being an Edmond guy, and I believe, does he still live out at Oaktree? I think he does.
I'm almost positive he does. I think that's at least he did when I was chatting with him at the old gas station.
Yeah. Holds the course record, by the way. I don't know if people know that. He holds the course record at Oaktree National. 61 he fired out there. And if you've ever played Oaktree National, if you ever played it from the tips, oh, buddy, 61 is unfathomable.
That's filthy. And he didn't get to – did he get to claim it? Because wasn't that part of that tournament where they couldn't let him accept any money, any winnings?
He did get to claim the course record. I don't believe he could claim any winnings, but he did get to claim the course record. Yeah. Have you ever played out there, and have you played it from the tips?
I've played out there, and I would never, ever, ever play from the tips out there.
Okay, I've played it a couple times. I played it once from the tips just for the experience. I've played it from the tips. I've played Carson from the tips. I've played Jimmy from the tips. And National is just, dude, it is a beast. 61 out there is truly, it just feels like whoever did that must have been playing a totally different sport than what the rest of us are playing.
Yeah, That's why he's on tour. That's why he's got his card. Let's do the Toast of the Week, brought to you by Yuengling, America's oldest brewery. We appreciate Yuengling sponsoring the podcast. Be sure to stop at your local gas stations if you might run into a PGA Tour player if you're roaming around the Edmond area. But we appreciate Yuengling sponsoring our Toast of the Week. Where are you headed this week, Colby?
I'm going to the Diamond. How about softball? How about, was this last night? This was last night. Oklahoma State softball advances to 18-2 on the season on a walk-off from a freshman. Rosie Davis stepped to the plate, bottom of the eighth inning, two outs, two strikes, sends a missile through the right side of the infield, and Oklahoma State walks it off 4-3. The freshman, last week it was Oklahoma State baseball with the freshman, who both got on board in the 14th inning before a suicide squeeze brought in the winning run. And then last night for Oklahoma State softball, it was a freshman with the walk-off single out into right field. Two strikes, two outs, just brilliant stuff from these young kids who are seemingly more and more ready for these moments earlier in their careers. It's cool to watch. And I don't watch these games live, but I love watching the highlights and seeing what happened with all this stuff. I kind of start watching them live as we get later into the season, into conference play, and they start to matter a whole lot more. But great stuff on the diamond for both the men and the women.
Yep, that's good stuff. I'm going to go with just us, the general public, college football fans. I don't own a video game console anymore. Maybe I should get one. I don't think my wife would probably like that. But we've got college football coming back to our lives, the college football video game. A lot of players have opted in. Ollie Gordon's is going to play in it or be in the game. I loved what Alan Bowman said. Someone tweeted at him. I think it was Willie Football tweeted at him, asked him if he was going to be in the game. And he said, I am in the game. And he signed it, Alan Bowman, MD. How great is that? As in, a lot of people go to college for 7 years. Yeah, they're called doctors. He signed his name as Alan Bowman, MD, because he's going into his seventh year of college. I thought that was fantastic. A toast to our quarterback who wears magnificent throwback jerseys and can have a little humor and sign his name with MD on the back of it.
Yeah, Alan Bowman, personality-wise, he seemed like a really fun guy. The throwbacks last year, what you mentioned there on Twitter, the interviews, he's a good speaker. He seems like a fun guy to hang around.
Yep, I totally agree. You ready for some Twitter questions, or do you want to pour one out?
Yeah, I was going to pour one out. Yeah, pretty disturbing news this week with seven people being laid off from sellout crowd, which announced itself to the Oklahoma sports world just 7 months ago. And they made it one football season before things kind of seemed to have come undone. It seemed like there were some empty promises to some of the talent, some good people, and some good employees, good journalists in this state, who left good jobs, premier jobs in Oklahoma sports media to go be a part of something that was supposed to be special. And I don't know exactly what the business model was. I don't have a ton of inside information there, but Carson, I was very disappointed to see that some good people this early into the venture, I don't know what the business model was there, but man, what an absolute failure whenever you just launched and now you're already having to get rid of so many talented people who took a chance on you. Just pretty brutal, I thought, this week from sellout crowd.
Yeah, I feel really bad for the seven folks who were let go. I know many of them personally. I've texted one of them in particular. It's very disappointing. And just for clarity, I was approached by Mike Kaler, the CEO of Sellout, the now former CEO of Sellout Crowd, and it didn't get very far. We just had a call together, and he kind of told me the idea, kind of was interested in me doing a show twice a week. I just didn't have the bandwidth, the time, or the energy. I like doing this podcast. I just didn't have the time or energy to do that. So I didn't get into the nitty gritty of what it would look like in terms of backing financially and all those things. I don't know. I mean, just some really good people are now without a job, and I don't know what they were promised, but I did see like an ad deck. I think the Lost Ogle posted it for Todd Lisenby's show. And it just, the numbers just seemed outrageous for a sponsorship. If I were to be approached with that, I would be like, who's paying $15,000 a month to sponsor my podcast? That's just not how podcasting works. I don't know. Again, I don't know all the details, and there's certainly two sides to this story. There's the people who got laid off side of the story, and then there's certainly the sellout crowd side of it. I know they're continuing on it, but it's more than anything, Colby, I'm sad for the people first and foremost who lost their jobs. I've been laid off before. It's one of the worst feelings in the entire world. Just fills you with anger and rage and wonder as to why. But I'm also just sad for our state. Like, we all know the Oklahomans struggling. The newspapers are struggling. Sports radio is struggling. I don't know where media is going. And again, we've referenced sellout crowd articles a lot on here. That the Hutchins twins did a really good job covering Oklahoma State. I'm sad for them. I don't know where media is going. It's sad for me being a media guy, just wondering, you know, like where it's going to look like. And I still get asked sometimes to go back to my alma mater OSU and talk to some of the sports media folks. And part of me wants to tell them not to get into this because I don't know if there's going to be any jobs by the time they're out of school. I don't know. It's just thoroughly depressing.
It really is. It's a hard business to do full time and to make a living to support a family and to be able to continue to do it. I know you and I, you were at Channel 5 for a long time, and now you work a real job and you do this. And I spent several years with the franchise, several years on my own, a couple of years with NBC. And now I'm kind of working a real job and then doing this. And yeah, some of the money that was being thrown around for stuff for sellout crowd, I really don't know how much people think that podcasts make. There are about a million of these in every different space all across the internet, covering every possible avenue. There's not a lot of money in podcasting. You know, we do this because we love it. It's a lot of fun. We enjoy the listener interaction. We enjoy having a platform that Pistol Firing has provided us. We're not doing it because we're getting rich. I just don't know what all went into the thought process there. And I've gone back to Oklahoma State and spoken to a class. It was a few years ago, and I was pretty honest with them about how much money you're going to make coming out. And I think a lot of people would be shocked at just how little money most people make in this industry and how hard it is to make this a career. The promises that were apparently made by sellout crowd just have not come to fruition. And it is a bummer. So, Carson, before we move on from Yingling, I do want to give out one more toast of the week. You good with me giving out one more toast?
Yeah, absolutely. You got plenty to go around.
So one of our listeners, Luis Rodarte, who I mentioned a few weeks ago, his wife needs to get a toast of the week because he sent me a picture of their anniversary gift, and they are custom Oklahoma State matching Chucks that say pistols firing on the back. And I mean, they are so beautiful. They're all black with orange, like an orange tongue, an orange stripe down the back with black font for the pistols firing, the Oklahoma State logo on the side, the brand, the Converse All-Star logo on the back. Like, these are some of the sweetest custom shoes that anybody has tweeted at us. So a Yuengling toast of the week going out to Lewis's wife, who absolutely crushed it.
That's fantastic. You can't get those at Chris's.
No, these are beautiful, man. These are beautiful.
That's fantastic. Shout out to him. A toast of a hearty Yuengling to him as well. You ready for Twitter questions?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Let's see here. Where do we want to start? It's from Tyler Wheat. Predictions on how donor fatigue affects college athletics, specifically Oklahoma State, 5 years from now, 10 years and beyond, particularly if there are no improved results despite improved NIL dollars. I'm already kind of seeing this, Colby. I saw, I think Alan Kenny is his name, blatant homerism on Twitter. He was kind of retweeting some similar sentiments from OU fans about, you know, why are we being asked to front all the financing for NIL and players? Like, we want to support the program, but at what point is it on the university who makes all the money off of our ticket sales and everything else? So I think that fatigue's already kind of here, Colby. So I don't know where this is going 5-10 years from now, but I think the fatigue's already setting in.
Yeah, 5 and especially 10 years from now, I think college athletics is going to look much different than it does today. And I don't know how much of that's going to be better and how much of that is going to be worse. Things are going to have to change. It's unsustainable what's happening right now in collegiate athletics. There was a big story this week where the Dartmouth men's basketball team voted to join an existing union on campus because a court ruled that they can be employees who receive the same results. Now, maybe that spreads like wildfire throughout collegiate athletics, which I think would be good for football and men's basketball at some places. I really don't know how other sports survive, non-revenue sports survive in an era that goes beyond the football program providing for the rest of the university. But also fans, I mean, crowdfunding your roster every year, it's not sustainable. It's not sustainable at Oklahoma State. It's not sustainable anywhere else because you just give every year more and more and more and more. And then after you give, you're told, hey, to keep these guys, we've got to give more. And yeah, it's just not sustainable to keep going on like that forever. So I think the landscape of collegiate athletics in 5 and 10 years is going to look so much different than it does now. At some point, the billions of dollars from these TV contracts that keep getting bigger and bigger, that money is going to have to flow to the players in the sports that get these TV contracts, which means you'll have to ask less of your fans and your donors to give money. But once the money from the TV contracts starts going to the players in those sports who are generating all of that revenue, I mean, what happens to softball? What happens to baseball? What happens to golf? What happens to soccer, volleyball, wrestling, all these other schools that don't have millions and billions of dollars rolling in? I really don't know. So I think some things are going to make college sports better as we evolve, and I think some things are going to make college sports worse in many ways for the non-revenue sports especially. So these court cases that keep coming down and the changes that keep being made, if you're tired of college athletics, it's only going to continue to evolve, I think, in massive, massive ways over the next 5 to 10 years. So we'll see. We'll see what of that is good and what of that is bad.
Yeah, it's a lot of unknowns. This is from Dylan Cox. Any thoughts on the proposed 14-team college football playoff model? According to reports, it would give Big Ten and SEC schools 3 automatic bids, while the ACC and Big 12 would receive 2 automatic bids. Mike Gundy was asked about this, and it also, the part of the proposal was that the Big Ten and SEC champs get an automatic bye. I just love when Mike brings some levity and reason to these ridiculous proposals. He says, quote, this is Mike Gundy, quote, a playoff format that guarantees a first round bye to any team, division, or conference before the season starts is unheard of in any sport as far as I'm aware. Based on the premise proposed, a team could be undefeated and ranked number 1 in the country and still not receive a first-round bye because teams were awarded one before the season even began. Like, Remember the good faith I was showing when we discussed the 12-team model and in terms of how many Big 12 schools we get in? I was dealing in good faith, thinking, you know, logic will prevail. They won't just lump in three Big 12 or Big 10 and SEC schools and screw the Big 12. But it appears they're already trying to do that before they even change the 12. They're already trying to do it with the 14 that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, I want to go on the record that I think 12 is perfect. I've hated every system prior to this one. I thought they were all massively flawed because you had way too many teams that weren't deserving or that were deserving of playing for national championships over the years that have not been able to. But I think 12 is perfect. Moving to 14 is goofy. And the idea that you would hand out a first round bye, I mean, the Chiefs have won three Super Bowls now in the last, what, 5 or 6 years? Let's give them a first round bye next year. Don't bother playing the games. Baltimore this past season, I know you had a great year. I know that you won the most games. I know you were the best team in the league throughout the regular season, but we're going to get the Chiefs the first round bye. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't happen in any other sport. It's lunacy. It's absolute lunacy. Imagine a year, and this is, maybe it'll happen someday, maybe it won't, but imagine a year in which the Big Ten and ACC championship each had two losses throughout the season, and the Big 12 and the ACC both had teams that were undefeated, 13-0 going into the postseason. And you're going to tell me that a two-loss Ohio State and a two-loss Georgia get the byes over a 13-0 Oklahoma State and a 13-0 Florida State? That just, woo, buddy, that makes no sense.
Yeah, it lacks logic, but again, the Big Ten and SEC are kind of running things, so I'm a little concerned about that coming to fruition, frankly. I got time for a couple more, Colby. There's a couple we won't be able to get to. Maybe we can table them for next time. But this one got a lot of interaction. It's from John Bonner. It says, how much of the blame of the current state of OSU basketball lies with Holder? Horrible extension with Ford. Misplayed the Underwood situation. Hired an inexperienced head coach and then gave that coach an extension that it's basically impossible to get out of. So I think almost all the blame comes with Holder. I think he made a lot of poor decisions. There's certainly two sides to the Underwood story. I understand that, but it's your job to keep a coach that everyone loved and all those things. So I think Holder did about as poor of a job with basketball as possibly could be done. Now, a lot of this is hindsight. When Ford made the tournament and won a game, everyone was scared to death Kentucky was going to come get Travis Ford. That sounds absolutely ludicrous now, but he played at Kentucky, and I'm telling you, I was there. OSU folks were a little worried about Kentucky coming to get Travis Ford, so he locked him up. Underwood, total misplay. They're still hurting from that. No absolution from that. I think a lot of the blame does fall on Mike Holder, and it's Chad Weiberg's job to clean things up.
Yeah, I think so, too, with the basketball program specifically. Holder obviously did some great things with other sports, but yes, it is hindsight, and we're looking back at the results and now judging that. But, I mean, it's kind of how you're judged, right? As an AD, you're judged on the results. You're judged on being the person in charge of making that decision, and however it plays out, you're responsible for it. So, yeah, I think Mike Holder deserves a large chunk of the blame for where Oklahoma State men's basketball is at this moment. Do you have time for one more? Do you have time to rank the road football games that you'd most like to be at, or do you want to do that next week?
Let's table that. Let's do that next week. I got to run. I got a meeting coming up, but, but yeah, this was, great show, Colby. And, I guess we'll have a great weekend and we'll chat with you next week.
Yep. Sounds good. We'll get to that next week. We're going to rank the 6 road football games from easiest to toughest. And then the ones we would most, and least like to see live. So that'll be a lot of fun. Carson, great stuff. Appreciate everyone listening as always. Go Pokes.